Hello and welcome to The Europeans, a podcast about the crazy, confusing and sometimes concerning news from this cornucopia of a continent.
Ooh.
I feel like using a fancy word today.
Good summary.
I'm Dominic Kramer, one of your hosts, speaking to you from Amsterdam. And down the line, there's a Katie Lee in Paris.
There is a Katie Lee in Paris. How are you, Dominic, in Amsterdam?
I'm fine. I think I'm better than you.
I'm very sick. Do you know what's been making me feel better, though?
What?
I spent a good chunk of the past week transfixed by the goings-on in the European Parliament, which sounds improbable, but it's true. Can we talk about how spicy EU politics suddenly got this week?
Right. It's so rare that like viral clips of speeches at the European Parliament end up on my feed and that friends are sending me clips of things that a member of the European Parliament said, but it actually happened, which... yeah, I'm still getting over, to be honest.
If you don't know what we're talking about, Viktor Orban, the Hungarian Prime Minister, showed up in the European Parliament last week to give a big speech because Hungary currently holds the EU presidency. And after that speech, there was a debate during which politician after politician slammed Orban, like calling him out for everything he has done to dismantle democracy in Hungary, trampling on LGBTQ rights, trampling on migrant rights. At one point, some politicians from the left started singing Bella Ciao, this famous Italian song of anti-fascist resistance.
This is not the Eurovision, eh?
I should say there was also quite a lot of clapping for Orban from the far-right members of parliament, who are fairly strong in numbers these days. But it was just really... the kind of politics that you want to watch with popcorn in a way that I really don't usually experience EU politics. And maybe it's kind of immature of me to want politics to be entertaining, but I do also think if it was more watchable like this more of the time, maybe people would pay more attention, huh?
Yeah, I agree. It was essentially a roast of Orban, right? He was red to filth.
Very enjoyable.
But we're not going to be talking about Orban this week. We've got much more important things to talk about, like semi-naked roller skating nuns.
Can't wait.
Shall we talk about what's coming up in the show?
Yeah, what is coming up on the show?
Well, later on in the episode, Katie is going to be chatting to one of the journalists behind an impressive investigation into the recruiting of criminals through the messaging app Telegram. Yes, people who are being paid to commit acts of sabotage that promote Russia's interests. And it's all being arranged through this app, Telegram. It's really quite a disturbing world these journalists have been diving into. We'll be finding out more about how it's happening and who is behind the recruitment of these criminals later on in the show. But first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Right, I feel like we have to start with the roller skating nuns, presumably. Who has had a bad week, Dominic?
Yeah, well, I think I should first mention that if you've got kids listening, you might want to skip this segment. It's not very child-friendly. But I am giving bad week to the Staatsoper Stuttgart, the state opera in Stuttgart. Reluctantly, I don't want my opera career to be ruined, but I'm giving it to them after a piece by the director and performance artist Florentina Holzinger called Sancta opened in Stuttgart last week and resulted in 18 people in the audience requiring medical help because of the extreme things they saw depicted on stage.
Yikes.
I have to say right up front that I actually wanted to give Holzinger a good week, but Katie wouldn't allow me. Because from what I've seen and read, it seems really artistically impressive what she is doing. So it's a very reluctant bad week. And I'm not saying the show is bad. But yeah, the news story that's gone around the globe is about how intense the physical reaction was from some audience members. And following the performance and the media attention, Holzinger has apparently also received threats and hate speech directed at her and her team. So I think if not a bad week, it's definitely a not nice week for quite a lot of people.
I am quite interested to hear this. Apparently very different take of yours though, Dominic. It seems like you're the only person in the international media who seems to be saying, oh, there's actually something good about this. So I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
Well, I thought we could start by like watching the trailer together and you can get an idea of what it looks like and you can describe, Katie, to our listeners what you're seeing.
Okay, can't wait for this.
Okay, I'm just sending you the link.
Okay, I see a nun. She's crossing herself. Very nun-like.
And then two naked women.
It's sort of like Sister Act, but really more intense than Sister Act.
Here's some women with blood, and there's a nun being spanked.
There is a dwarf nun on a robot arm being turned around upside down. Oh, someone's been crucified. That's not good. Wow, what did I just watch?
Are you shocked and do you need medical attention?
I mean, I do need medical attention because I've got a really bad cold, but not from the trailer, no. I thought the trailer was kind of fun.
Right. There are some quite incredible images packed into the 50 seconds of the trailer. I'll put a link to it in the show notes if you feel like getting an idea of what this show is about. But yeah, there are lots of religious images of women on the cross, of semi-naked nuns, including one on roller skates. Lots of nudity, some BDSM, some hints of some quite horrific things too, with blood and stuff. And the opera Sancta, it's based on an opera written in 1922 by Paul Hindemith, a piece called Susanna Sancta, which tells the story of the sexual awakening of a nun who, spoiler alert, at the climax of the opera, rips off her nun's habit, runs up to the altar and pulls off the loincloth from Jesus on the cross.
Oh, that's hot stuff.
As you might guess from that plot piece, the opera was already quite controversial in 1922 and was actually banned from being performed in many places. So it's interesting that it's stirring up controversy again just over 100 years later. But Holzinger, an Austrian performance artist who's directing the show, she's known for quite shocking performances, usually featuring casts of naked women with various bodily fluids and or sexual acts. And she's taken this piece by Paul Hindemith and mixed it with elements of the Catholic liturgy in order to, quote, create a new and radical vision of the Holy Mass ritual.
It did need an update for 2024.
Apparently it did. Just to give you an idea of the kind of work Holzinger makes. She actually studied in Amsterdam, so I know a lot of people who have seen a lot of her work. And one of my friends went to see one of her pieces where a woman did a shit on stage and then started throwing the shit around.
Oh, wow. Quite impressive to do that on cue.
It is.
You must have to just eat the exact right thing before performing. I've got so many questions.
Yeah, actually, she has this amazing quote. She comes from a kind of dance background and she says, "Good technique in dance to me is not just someone who can do a perfect tendu, but also someone who can urinate on cue."
Absolutely.
So this kind of gives you an idea of the work that she makes. And it's definitely not easy work. And it's work that made 18 people sick watching it this past week. The trigger warning on the website of the Opera House gives you maybe a good idea of why maybe it made them sick. It says, "This performance depicts explicit sexual acts as well as representations and descriptions of sexual violence. It also features real blood and stage blood, piercing processes, and the infliction of wounds."
Wowza.
This is all real. The performance also includes strobe effects, high volume, and incense. I love that incense is included in the trigger warning.
If you weren't got by the live piercing, it's the wafts of gentle frankincense that are going to get you.
Exactly. I think it was that that made them sick. I haven't seen the show myself yet, so I don't know how I would respond to it, but I don't want to underplay the significance of the event for the people who fell sick. People can have extreme physical reactions to art, and I'm sure it was very unpleasant for them. That said, I think the trigger warning is pretty clear that this show is quite extreme and it's only open to people aged 18 and over. And I think the Opera House does a pretty good job with their detailed trigger warnings about what is going to be seen during the performance. And there's also a question and answer section on the website that goes into more details about why some of these things are depicted.
So this is kind of adjacent to the world that you work in. Am I correct, Dominic? You do sing a lot of contemporary opera in your other life as a singer. You've played a sea creature, a mushroom in the past.
Among my other great roles.
Does this sound like the kind of show you would genuinely want to go and see?
Yeah, interesting question. I actually noticed that the conductor of this show is someone I've worked with quite a lot. She's a great Swedish conductor called Marit Strindland. So it is very adjacent to the world that I work in. And I don't think I'd be in this show because it's an all-female cast. But
but if it wasn't?
If it wasn't, I'd be there. I feel mixed about whether I would really want to see it. Apparently there's a scene where a bit of skin is cut from the side of a performer and it's then grilled to represent Whoa. The body of Christ during Eucharist.
Oh my God, I don't even need to see that to need medical attention. I'm sorry. Also, how do they do that night after night?
Yeah, I was also wondering that. I think they don't do many shows and they're quite spread out. And I assume it's a very small bit of skin. yeah, I mean, it's really something I don't need to see as well. But on the other hand, I am so intrigued by this production, and it sounds really groundbreaking and original, and it's been incredibly well received by critics. The Süddeutsche Zeitung, for example, described it as joyful and exuberant rather than scandalous.
Apart from the bits when the flesh was being grilled.
Yeah, although maybe that is joyful and exuberant. I don't know. We haven't seen it in context.
Who doesn't like a barbecue?
It's also worth mentioning that all the performances in Stuttgart that remain are now sold out, as is the run that's coming up in Berlin at the Volksbühne. So maybe it's not such a bad week for the Opera House in Stuttgart. And I actually think I do want to see it because I'm so intrigued by it, about like how it manages to be so extreme and apparently humorous at the same time, whilst making a critical point about the Catholic Church's control of women's bodies and women's sexuality.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of nice to hear that the critics have liked it. I mean, if you read the sort of scandalized headlines, you would think this is just a bunch of attempts to be provocative that don't make you think or feel. But it really seems like it isn't that.
Yeah, I really think it isn't. And I think, of course, violence for the sake of violence on stage is bad. But it seems like in the context of the show and what she's trying to tell, there's good reason for why she's showing what she wants to show. And actually, there was quite an interesting statement that Holzinger put out on Instagram this week. She feels that the media reporting has indeed been like sensationalist and full of clickbait headlines. I mean, I kind of don't blame the media. Who can resist having a headline about topless, roller skating, lesbian nuns? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, she is making a really serious point with this show. So it must feel a bit weird to have all this media attention about how extreme it is. And she makes the point out that most of the journalists who are writing about it haven't actually seen the show. And here I am talking about the show having also not seen it. But I can try to put it in context with the help of the words of the artist herself. In her words, the show focuses on the church's portrayal of women and examines the mechanisms behind the church's centuries-long treatment and influence on the female body and sexuality. In her final paragraph, she says, pretty bitingly, "Those who don't want to see it shouldn't come. Above all, anyone who cannot handle depictions of violence should not attend a show with explicit references to the Catholic Church."
Hmm.
Which is, yeah, quite a statement. So, yeah, despite this show being a show that's apparently getting bad week because Katie made me give it bad week, I think it's good that an artist is allowed to create a sacrilegious performance like this that is critical of the Catholic Church. That this can go ahead makes me realise we have made some progress since 1922 when Paul Hindemith first wrote this opera and performances were banned. I personally am so happy to live in a part of the world where work like this is not censored. We don't have to all go and see it, but thank goodness it's allowed.
Yeah, hear, hear. I tell you what, you can go and exercise the freedom to go and see it, and I will exercise my freedom to stay home and watch something less stressful.
I respect that. Who has had a good week, Katie?
Well, I really wanted to talk about something fun this week, aside from roller skating nuns. We haven't had enough fun on the show lately. There have been too many far-right election wins and that kind of thing. And I have been dying to talk about the fact that someone has finally solved the treasure hunt that has been a kind of mild background cultural obsession here in France for the past 30 years. And that is the hunt.
The owl.
Yes, the owl. How much do you know about the golden owl?
Like nothing, really, apart from I heard that the owl was found.
Okay, so let me take you back to the beginning. The year is 1993, and I don't know if this is true in all European countries, but certainly in Britain and in France, there is a bit of a craze for treasure hunts. So there are these TV shows like Fort Boyard and The Crystal Maze, and in both countries, there are also these real-life treasure hunts that members of the public can get involved with. So in Britain, there's this game called Masquerade, where you could buy a book with these puzzles in it that lead to a real-life statue of a golden hare that has been buried somewhere in the country. That treasure hunt started in the UK in 1979, and it got solved a few years later. In France, they set up something very similar. So there was this guy called Max Valentin. He worked in marketing, And in 1993, he published a book of 11 enigmas, they were called. These very weird, cryptic puzzles. So some of them have got like strings of numbers and letters in them. Some of them are these strange, cryptic poems that say things like, show your respect for Mother Nature, and before you leave, close the wound.
Oh, and fry it on the stage.
And fry it along with some of your flesh. And supposedly, if you solved all of these super weird puzzles, they would lead you to an exact spot somewhere in France where you would find, buried in the earth, a small statue of a golden owl. Now, the little owl being buried in the ground was actually a cheap replica of the real thing, because if you managed to dig it up, you would receive, as your prize, the real Schwitz d'Or, or golden owl, which was this 10-kilo statue of an owl made of gold and silver with little diamonds and rubies on it. Quite tacky looking, to be honest, but apparently worth around 150,000 euros in today's money.
Whoa.
And of course, you'd also win the glory of having found this thing. And that glory is, of course, priceless.
So people have been looking for this thing for 30 years. That's quite amazing.
30 years. It's sometimes billed as the world's longest treasure hunt. And to be honest, I think people expected this thing to be found a lot quicker than it was. Over the years, tens of thousands of people have wasted many tens of thousands of hours poring over these puzzles and trying to find the owl. These obsessives got their own nickname. They were called Schwetters, or Owlers. They set up a legal non-profit to represent their interests. And literally, like, the mayor of one village in the north of France eventually had to plead with people to stop digging up his village because so many of these owlers were convinced that the clues led there. And Max Valentin, over the years, he continued to drop these little clues on Minitel, which was this early French version of the internet. And so he managed to sustain this sense of mystery and hype around it. Then in 2009, Max Valentin died without living to see his treasure hunt solved. And he died without telling anyone where to find the damn owl. He did leave the solution to the puzzle in a sealed envelope with his family. But then there were years of legal disputes over what to do with the envelope and who would have the right to take over as the master of the mysteries.
Wow. This sounds like an amazing script for a movie coming.
Ha! Hold that thought. Eventually, the weighty responsibility of taking over as the master of mysteries is given to Michel Becker, who is the guy who illustrated the original puzzle book, the physical puzzle book with all of the clues in it. He also designed the owl itself. So Michel finally gets to learn where this owl is buried in the middle of the French countryside, presumably.
Oh, even he didn't know.
Even he didn't know. It was literally just the other guy, the guy who wrote the clues, who went out in the dead of night and buried it. Even the owl designer did not know. So finally, after his partner dies, Michel, the other guy, gets all of the information about where the owl actually is. He goes there, he checks that the owl is still indeed in the ground. No one's found it. And the game starts again. And by now we're in the internet era. So of course there's like a gazillion message boards picking over every single line of these puzzles and what they might mean. There's also more controversy. So at one point, Michel tries to sell the owl and the sale has to get blocked by the courts on the ground that it's not actually his owl. The owl belongs to the eventual winner of the treasure hunt, but they just haven't claimed it yet. One Parisian who has been looking for this thing for 20 years actually sues Michel and the family of the previous puzzle master guy, trying to force him to reveal the solution. And the whole thing just generally continues being mad for years. Fast forward to about 2 weeks ago, October the 2nd. It is late at night, 11 p.m., and Michel Becker, this guy who's taken over as the master of the treasure hunt, he gets a phone call from an unknown number, and he hears this voice giving him the password that is buried with the owl. It's been found!
Whoa.
Cue complete mania in the owl hunting community. The Discord channel that is now around, because remember, it's not 1993 anymore, so this treasure hunt is now on Discord. The Discord channel is alive with people asking a gazillion questions. Is it true? Is this person definitely the legit winner? Did they cheat? Could they have used a metal detector? And above all, where in France did they find it? What is the answer?
And what is the answer? I mean, would using a metal detector be cheating? Come on.
I think it really would be. It's not in the spirit of the thing. But this is the thing. We still don't know. So the latest update came last Sunday when Michel appeared on YouTube to give more details. It was all very dramatic. He was blacked out like a kind of anonymous source in a documentary. And he confirmed that someone had indeed properly solved the mystery, provided proper solutions to the puzzles, and of course, dug up the owl itself. We don't really know anything about the person that found it because they have asked to remain anonymous. But we do know that they have been given the real golden owl and that this precious object has been taken, quote, far away from France.
Oh.
So apparently the winner maybe isn't French or certainly doesn't live here. That's kind of all we know about them, though. And there are still so many mysteries. Like, all of the owl hunters were dying to see this YouTube video on Sunday because they wanted answers. But Michelle still hasn't made public the solutions to the puzzles. We still don't know where the owl was buried. And that is because, da-da-da-da, there's going to be a film coming out.
Oh. A documentary film.
Yeah, a kind of documentary where apparently some of the people who have dedicated way too much time to finding this owl over the years are also going to appear in it. We're not going to find out about the winner themselves because they do strictly want to remain anonymous, but we are going to find out where the owl was buried. And they're going to announce the start of a new treasure hunt.
Oh, God.
You're not interested in taking part?
No.
Not your thing.
It's not for me, but I do find it really charming that it exists.
I think so too. I mean, it's quite rare in 2024 to have a story that is as harmless as this one. Like, yes, there have been these ugly moments in the history of the treasure hunt, like it literally ended up in court. But at the end of the day, it's a story about people's love of solving puzzles and mysteries for fun and their ability to get completely obsessed with something that really doesn't matter. And I find that very charming.
And I like that it involves the real world. I mean, obviously the internet is involved, but you actually have to find it in the real world, which makes me feel weirdly nostalgic these days.
It reminded me of, do you remember that time when I went to Seville a week before you did and I left you a note in a bush?
Yes!
Fun times.
That was the best thing ever.
We're going to try and dig up the footage of that because there is a little video somewhere of Dominic finding it in a bush. And it was a very exciting moment. Anyway, I want to give good week to the mysterious winner of the Golden Owl. This person, or persons, were actually offered 300,000 euros by a museum dedicated to this treasure hunt for the owl, but they have refused it. They just want to hang on to it.
Wow.
It's been a less good week for the frustrated owl hunters on the Discord channel who still want their answers and they're going to have to wait a little bit longer.
Katie, have you watched this new Netflix series called Nobody Wants This?
Yes, I have. I gobbled it up. It's very enjoyable.
And were you equally annoyed that one of the main characters is a podcaster? She's got a podcast with a sister. And the depiction of podcasting in this show is so ridiculously unrealistic. People just like swan into a room, swan in home, and there's a microphone there, and then they just start having a chat, and it makes it look like there's no work behind the podcast they're making.
They were also holding the microphones in a way that I'm pretty sure would have caused a bunch of unpleasant noise on the mic. They don't know what they're doing, but they managed to get a huge Spotify deal out of it.
I know. It really irritated me because actually making a podcast is quite a lot of work, which is why we can only do it thanks to support from our lovely Patreon supporters. Thank you, everyone who is donating each month to keep this podcast afloat. We have a few new people to thank this week, don't we, Katie?
We do. They are Jeanette, Patrick, Fabian, Daniel, Agnes, Minsuk, Richmond, Belinda, Andre. And there are also several listeners who were already supporting us and decided to be extra amazing this week and increase their donations. And they are James, Willem, Lisa, Chris, Johannes, FG, and Marine.
It's amazing. Thank you all so much. Every time we get a little ping in our email saying that someone has decided to support us, it really makes our day and makes it all feel worth it. The hard work of making a podcast, which wasn't depicted in the Netflix show. You can join them by heading to patreon.com/Europeans Podcast.
So there was this investigation that caught my eye last week, one of these big media investigations by journalists from lots of different outlets across Europe. And it was looking at these kind of low-key acts of sabotage that have been happening across Europe lately. Small fires, vandalism on NATO military bases and vehicles. Individually, none of these things make particularly big headlines, but they do seem to be part of a pattern. And that is a pattern of individual Europeans, often with a background in small-time crime, being recruited on social media to carry out acts of sabotage that favour Russia's agenda. It's something that security services in different countries seem to have been aware of for a while now. And it's also something that the journalists who carried out this investigation have witnessed themselves. There was this ad floating around on Telegram inviting sympathisers of Russia living within Europe to join the fight against Ukraine's Western allies. Our guest today is Marta Wunsch. She is a reporter covering misinformation and disinformation and generally shady corners of the internet for the Estonian news website Delfi. And she and her colleagues wondered, what would actually happen if they replied to this ad, if they wrote back to the Telegram account that had been inviting Europeans to join this fight? What would it say? I'll let her tell you all about it. I gave Marta a call in Tallinn. Marta, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So this story starts with a guy called Valery Ivanov. Who is Valery Ivanov?
Valery is an Estonian guy who wants to earn more money. He's quite desperate. He's from eastern part of Estonia. He's speaking Russian, doesn't care much about politics or anything. He just wants money. And he discovered this Privet bot.
And we'll get to Privet bot in a minute. But spoiler alert, Valery is not a real guy. You invented him. Why did you give him these characteristics?
Because we wanted him to be super like a simple Estonian guy. We wanted to go and just ask for money. We were not trying to be super ideological or like pro-Russia because we didn't know what they expect. We knew that they offer money, so we acted like a guy who wants money. That's it.
And you built a very detailed profile for Valery. I mean, he had a very detailed job description. He had a family story. Why was it so important to make him feel like such a three-dimensional character?
Because we wanted him to be as real as possible. That's why we created a fictional persona with a full backstory. We made full social media presence for him. We even had to create a fake ID document photo because we assumed they're going to ask for it. We also prepared answers about his background, including military service, family, work experience, because we didn't know how much they will ask us, how much we have to prepare. That's why we did as much as possible. So, for example, if they ask, what's your occupation? And if he says, I'm a truck driver, then maybe they will ask for any kind of proof, like, hey, send a picture of your truck. So we had to be ready for everything. That's why we chose an occupation, land surveyor.
Which is quite specific.
Yeah, because one of us has had an experience with this field and great contacts. Other people were ready to help us in case they would ask for pictures or anything like this.
Mm-hmm. And so he gets into a conversation with this account on Telegram called PrivetBot. It's not actually a bot, is it?
No, it's not a bot. It's an account where like there's a real person on the other end who speaks directly to the potential recruits. And on Telegram, the terms like bot or chatbot are used for accounts that have like some automated features, but the only automated things were choose your language and choose your country. That's it. And after that, there was a real person talking to us.
So Valery gets into conversation with this mysterious person on the other end of Telegram. How did this conversation go?
It went quite well in journalistic sense because we got quite a lot of useful information. We got to know what they're interested in, how they like test a person, how they identify a person. And it was quite surprising.
What was the first thing that you said to this account?
We just said, Privet.
Hi.
Hi, yeah.
And what did it say back?
It said, hi, why did you contact us? We, as Valery, we just answered that we thought that we can get some money from here, so that's why we contacted you.
And quite quickly, the person on the other end of this conversation was suggesting Valery could carry out acts of sabotage that would help Russia. I mean, what kind of acts are we talking about?
Oh, this got quite serious quite quickly. They are interested in military equipment. They wanted Valery to burn Ukrainian military vehicles, to burn trucks transporting military stuff. And they also asked if we have ever killed, because they also asked us if we could kill a fascist, as they said.
And then added loads of smiley faces to the end of his messages, which, like, how weird.
It was weird for us as well, because, like, we're talking about killing people and he's smiling, like, putting those goofy smiley faces.
Oh my goodness.
And he also smiled after we said that, yeah, we were in a fight at a bar and the police came and he was like, great job.
It must have been quite shocking for the team to see these, you know, requests that this fake person, Valery Ivanov, might potentially murder someone for money. I mean, were you guys as a team quite surprised in general by how this conversation went?
Yeah, we were not expecting this at all. We thought that they would test us and then we would fail and then that's it. But we kind of got through those testing questions and then, as I said, it got very serious very quickly and we were quite shocked.
And so this mysterious person offered you money to commit various acts of sabotage. Can you tell us a little bit about what was on offer?
Yeah, he offered us money and he said up to 10,000 American dollars per mission, they call it a mission, for acts of sabotage against military targets in Europe and also for killing. So 10,000 for a guy like Valery, it sounds like a super great deal and he would be ready to do anything. We actually don't know if they would pay anything, like even if everything goes well, even if he doesn't get caught, will he ever see this money or no? We don't know.
And so you and your journalist colleagues from lots of different European media outlets, you showed this conversation, the transcript of the conversation, to security services in various countries. What did they make of this conversation?
Yeah, we can't definitively identify who is behind the PrivatBot account, like who, what kind of service was behind it. However, like security officials and experts and intelligence officials we talked to and showed the original chat transcript to, they strongly suspect Russian involvement. They point to Russian special services because it resembled what they have seen before. They said that this style and this like manner is matching what they have seen before.
And when you say what they've seen before, it's interesting because before I read your investigation, I didn't actually know that the kinds of small acts of sabotage that this account was offering to pay you for, you know, for example, attacking a NATO vehicle somewhere in a NATO country like Estonia. In fact, these small acts of sabotage have already been happening across Europe for a while now. And I guess we don't hear about them very often because they are quite small in scale, but there have been quite a few of them. Can you tell me about some of these things that have been happening across Europe?
Yeah, well, since I'm from Estonia, maybe I'll start with an Estonian example. Last December, the cars of our Minister of Interior and a journalist of a Russian news outlet, their cars were broken. And yeah, those people were recruited by Kremlin officials. In Latvia, the Museum of Occupation was attacked. They tried to set it on fire. And yeah, many more cases. For example, in Lithuania, the IKEA store, and in Germany, the US bases were planned to be attacked.
And from the evidence that we have, there is some suggestion that the perpetrators were paid to do this by Russian government services or intelligence services. I mean, recruiting foot soldiers to do these fairly low-key acts of sabotage, starting small fires, vandalizing cars, it doesn't do that much damage to Russia's enemies in Europe, in the grand scheme of things. What's the point of it?
We have talked to experts and officials, as I said, and in their opinion, the main goal is to cause panic and distrust in society and just to create like confusion. Physical harm is not the main point because those acts and the real outcome is so small, it doesn't really harm anyone or anything. And they know this very well. It's just to show that, hey, we are here and we can do stuff and you cannot catch us. That's the main point. And some experts say also that there's a bigger political goal, that people will be, after some time, really scared, panicking, and they will elect officials who will be ready not to support Ukraine that strongly. Mm. That's like the bigger political stuff they want to achieve.
And I guess it's not that expensive for them.
Yeah, that's really cheap. You just post ads on Telegram and you get, I don't know, let's say 1,000 responses. And even if one or two people seem like serious, really are ready to do something, the goal is achieved and it's really cheap. And yeah, it's harder to link those cases to actual Russian like services.
I know this ad was posted on other platforms as well as Telegram, but Telegram does seem to be somewhere where Russian intelligence services are very present. For people who aren't very familiar with it, is there something about Telegram specifically that makes it especially useful for this kind of recruitment?
Yeah, Russian special services use Telegram a lot for their own internal communication and front communication and military communication. And yeah, they also recruit there because Telegram is allowing this to happen. Like, they don't take this stuff down. I mean, they took those channels in Europe down, partly, after our questions to them. But it's easy for them to use because those channels and groups are large. Telegram doesn't really limit how many people can join a channel or a group. It's super easy just to post stuff there, even such channels that are under sanctions in Europe.
Mm-hmm. And as far as you're able to tell from your reporting, how much do you think European security services are going to be able to stop this kind of sabotage from happening? Is there anything they can do? Well, not really.
Oh, that's a hard question for me. But of course, it's hard to stop, but it's also getting easier and easier to link this stuff to Russian services because it's a pattern and agencies and services have more and more experience with this kind of like sabotage recruitment stuff. But yeah, since this is happening on social media platforms such as Telegram and Meta and others also play a huge role here.
This feels like one of those investigations that isn't a smoking gun, but it does get us quite a lot closer to explaining this shady thing that has been happening and giving us a glimpse into what this recruitment process actually looks like. There are still lots of questions, obviously, but it's very intriguing nonetheless.
It really is.
I was chatting to our producer, Wojciech, after this interview, and he mentioned that he listened to a very interesting podcast about this kind of Russian recruitment of low-level agents in Europe. And it was talking about how the fact that a lot of Russian spies have been kicked out of Europe has left the Kremlin with this kind of information gap that it needs to fill. So it's been quite desperate to recruit people willing to spy for Russia as well as willing to commit sabotage. Very interesting stuff. It's in an episode of Talk Eastern Europe, which you will find in the show notes, along with, of course, the excellent investigation by Marta and her colleagues. We have a sponsored Inspiration Station segment for you this week. In fact, it's not even a station this week. We are transforming the Inspiration Station into a port? We're taking to the water.
Yes, our friends at the European Cultural Foundation wanted to share a project with you that they funded. It's called Liquid Becomings, and it's a project that's been running on four of Europe's biggest rivers for the past month or so.
And here to tell us a little bit more about it is producer Kat Slazdo. Hi, Kat.
Hi. Yes, I do like ports, so I went to go and visit one of the boats.
Intriguing. And tell me a little bit about this project in general, because I think it's a riff on this idea of these national pavilions that you find at art festivals like the Venice Biennale, right?
Yeah, so at these big art shows like the Venice Biennale, there are these national buildings. So each country that's inviting makes a building that has art expositions in it. And the idea of this was, what would a European pavilion look like? So art that represented the whole continent.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided that it would look like boats sailing down some of Europe's biggest rivers, which I find quite beautiful.
Yeah, I like that it's on the move.
Exactly. So they invited artists from 17 different countries, and they went on four of the biggest rivers in Europe, the Danube in August. So that went through Hungary, Croatia, and Serbia. Then there was the Vistula in Poland. I met them on the Rhine journey, which went through Germany and the Netherlands. And then the last journey will be on the Tejo River, and it'll be starting in Toledo in Spain, and it will be finishing all the way in Lisbon in Portugal.
And so you went to see one of these boats as it was docked in Rotterdam. What was it like?
Yes, I intercepted them just as they had arrived after traveling for 2 weeks. There were eight people on board, and they had clearly had quite a moment of grappling with the elements. This journey had a lot of rain and wind. Mm-hmm. And I also heard one of the other journeys on the Danube had quite a lot of problems with the heat. So it felt very fitting to this moment that Europe is facing of extreme weather.
Mm. Yeah, quite the metaphor.
And the idea was that they were on the boat developing their art together, which they will be presenting in Lisbon on land at a festival from November 7th to the 9th. We actually have a clip from Annetta Mays, who is one of the curators who was on board the boat. And she is talking about one of the things that made the biggest impression on her.
One of the images that really struck me when we were sailing down the Rhine, it was in Germany. And it was about halfway down our journey. We had seen all this industry. And then we came past a nuclear power station that had been transformed into a theme park for kids, nuclear fun for nuclear families. There was a big cooling tower with a merry-go-round on top of it, a roller coaster going around a nuclear power station. I'm not 100% sure what it's a metaphor for yet, but it was a metaphor for so many things. Commercialized leisure, ex-nuclear powers, transformation, all these different elements and a Europe trying to find new forms and trying to reinvent itself felt present within that one image.
Sounds like fun. Wish I was in Lisbon.
Yeah, Lisbon does sound good.
Wish I was anywhere other than Amsterdam right now. It's so grey and rainy here. I'm sorry they had to sail through our terrible weather.
Poor things.
Anyway, if you're interested, you can find out more on the Liquid Becomings website. They have a blog, so you can follow their trials and tribulations on the waters and find out details about the festival in Lisbon. So if you're Lisbon-based, check it out. Time for a happy ending to close out the show. And this week I'm taking you to a museum in the Netherlands, the Lam Museum in the town of Lisse, where it has emerged a mechanic accidentally threw an artwork into the trash. Now, in the mechanic's defense, the artwork was two cans of Upala beer and the piece was sitting in an elevator. So it did just look like someone had left two beer cans in a lift. And the mechanic was, in his defense, being quite tidy. What the mechanic didn't realize is that these two cans of beer are actually painstakingly created acrylic artworks designed to look just like beer cans, but they are art.
And they were put there in the lift as part of the display. Is that where they were supposed to be?
Yeah, they were meant to be there. Like, this gallery likes surprising people with putting things in unexpected places.
Oh.
I do have to ask myself how the mechanic didn't realise that they were made out of acrylic when he picked them up.
Yeah, he's just shoveling them in with all of the other rubbish, probably.
Maybe. Anyway, this is a happy ending. And the happy news is that the curator noticed, not much later in the day, that the artwork had disappeared from the lift and had the ingenuity to check the nearby bins. And the curator's hunch was correct. The artwork was in one of the bins and is now back on display, but not in a place where it could be mistaken again as trash. This time, the museum took the decision to put it on a plinth.
I think that seems wise.
It does. The response from the museum spokesperson was actually quite charming. She said that there were no hard feelings to the mechanic. He was just doing his job. So, Katie, you need to go back to bed because you're really not well.
I'm going to go back to bed and watch more terrible Netflix shows that misrepresent the lives of podcasters. That is all that we have time for this week. We're actually in the midst of planning our interviews for the rest of the year. So if there is something in particular that you think we should be talking about on the podcast, send us an email. We love hearing about things that aren't already on our radar. The email address is hello@europeanspodcast.com. Or you can just give us a shout on social media. You will find us in various places.
Various places. Katie is so sick she doesn't want to say them, which I respect. This week's episode was produced by Morgan Childs and Wojciech Oleksiak. Thank you both so much. We'll be back next week on Thursday in your feeds. Tell your friends about us. If you can't support us on Patreon, telling your friends about us is really, really also very helpful. Sorry, does that sound too needy?
It's fine. Needy's good.
Needy is good. Needy is necessary.
Have a great week, everyone.
Have a good week. Bye.
Nagami Seni.